You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
John Boehner has promised to make many changes as he takes on the role of Speaker of the Republican Majority House of Representatives, cutting government spending, keeping taxes low, lifting the country out of recession by lowering unemployment, rolling back health care reform, and he has to deal with an influx of new blood and new Tea Party-influenced ideas in Congress. Peter J. Boyer, staff writer for The New Yorker, looks at what the shakeup of Congress and the emergence of the Tea Party means for the Republican leadership in an article called House Rules, which appears in the December 13th issue of The New Yorker. I'm very pleased it brings him to our show today. Welcome back.
Hey, how are you, Leonard? It's good to be with you again.
You described Boehner's introduction to the Tea Party at a rally in Bakersfield, California. How long ago was that?
Well, it was one of the very first. It had been, the Obama administration had... The flag had barely raised on the Obama administration when the Tea Party talk started. The first big national hit came on Tax Day 2009, April 15th, and Boehner had heard that there were, he had read news reports, knew these things were going to be going on all over the country. He was planning to be in Bakersfield, a very conservative district in California, heard there was going to be one there, and join the crowd.
Now, many of the ideas that were being expressed were not unknown to the Republican leadership because they were similar to what Ron Paul had been saying for a while.
Yeah, there were. There was a certain energy from the Ron Paul movement, if I guess it's a reasonable thing to call it, and especially in the early days of the Tea Party. But there were an awful lot of Beltway Republicans who were every bit of as suspicious and standoffish toward the Tea Party as Democrats and the media was in their early going. I mean, the...
And some, like Karl Rove, continue to
absolutely.
Do battle.
That's right. They have, I mean, since then, it's courted the Tea Party has sort of morphed into a series of different personalities. So if you're sore at Sarah Palin, who in turn is beloved by the Tea Party, it makes you, therefore, ergo, angry at the Tea Party. And, the same thing with the Delaware Senate race and like that. But early on, the Republican Party was sort of two minds. They were so badly whipped in 2008, so thoroughly defeated that the moderates in the Republican Party kind of, wiped their brow and said, thank God we're going to actually spend some time in the wilderness so we can get rid of those crazy fundamentalists who ran us into the electoral ground. And there were an awful lot of people voicing that opinion, not just the public intellectuals on the right, but officials, a lot of them were in the Northeast, and who were really suspicious when this sort of anti-government, limited government appeal began to rise up. And then, of course, those voices were pretty quickly overcome by the popularity of that message.
Well, it's very different than the Republican Party of George Bush. How many new members are coming into the Congress? How many new Republican members are coming in?
Well, there are still a couple of contested races. There are, last count, I think now, 86 new members. Now, not all of them took seats from Democrats. Of course, some of them were open seats. Some were taking seats from that had been vacated by Republicans. But the thing that they have in common is that they were all formed by, each one of these incoming Republicans was formed by and is to some degree beholden to this sort of mood of deep disaffection regarding the federal government, regarding Washington. And that is, in a way, what makes it a Tea Party Congress, a Tea Party conference, even though they weren't all necessarily affiliated with the Tea Party.
Well, how long does it take for the learning curve to be achieved? After all, many of these people have really never served on this level or close to this level before.
Some of them have not, you're right. Some came from state legislatures and so on, but an awful lot of them are are amateurs in that sense, and deliberately so. I mean, that was the point of their candidacy. We're not professional politicians. We are citizen politicians. We're coming to Washington to change it. And in that sense, there are really two ways to answer your question. If in fact what they want to do is catch on to the, you know, quote unquote system, the way things operate in Washington, which I think is kind of part of what John Boehner would hope for, I think he and others are going to be in for a long wait, because they may not be interested in doing that. I do think that in terms of catching on to the exercise of power, they got that right away. They haven't been sworn in yet, and they're already throwing their weight around. They got greater representation at the leadership table, and I think we will see the newcomers be way more influential than freshman class have been in the past.
And the Republican Party is in the process of rebranding itself quickly. This is a process that usually takes years and involves much political infighting.
It was, as Boehner, I think, was one of those to recognize, just a miracle of good luck for the Republican Party. I think he knows, as do most, but not all, Republicans in Washington, that this was not an endorsement of the Republican Party of the last 8 years, or of the Republican brand, or of the leadership of John Boehner, or of George W. Bush's memory, or any of that. That this was, in fact, a convenient way to vote against Democrats and the status quo, and to protest the state of the economy. But because the economy and government spending are so much the overriding issues, and since Republicans embraced being the party of no, that meant that they were the de facto party of limited government and controlled spending. And that was what the Republican Party's greatest rationale, and it is what they had squandered. And they were, in being the party of no to Obama and the Democrats, they became, by default, the party that they once wanted to be identified as, which is the party of limited government.
Well, what about John Boehner? Does he have much in common with the Tea Partiers? I know he got into politics because, as a small business owner, he was upset about his tax rates, but that's just a limited connection, isn't it?
It is. He is not what you would call a Tea Party guy. You know, I mean, he is a 20-year. I mean, it was the Bush-Quayle administration when he came in as a freshman. That's a guy who is of Washington. His associations are there. His friendships are there. His career is there. On the other hand, as you say, he came into office as with one political identity, and that is, hey, as a small businessman, I paid way too much in taxes. The government's taking too much, and it had too much of a say in the affairs of my little business. And as it turns out, you know, this long cycle later, that is precisely what drove, that was the impulse that drove much of the protest vote. And, you know, so he was able, I think, to attach himself as well as the Republican brand to that impulse.
Mr. Boehner told you there's no daylight between the freshmen and any of our members or the leadership. Can that really be true?
No, can't be, and it's not. There is daylight aplenty, and will be more on the question, for example, of raising the debt ceiling. It's one of those things that it really is such a tedious, boring subject that you want to go beat your head against a stump when you actually bother to learn why we have that and what its effect is. But it's one of those sort of routine things that are kind of built into the system, especially in moments like this. And it's something that, if you don't do, has grave consequences. There are an awful lot of very vocal incoming Republican freshmen who are saying, no, we're not going to go along. We know everybody in Washington is saying we have to, or it's going to be disastrous for the bond markets, and for maybe there'll even be a government shutdown. No, that's not what we got elected for. Now, Boehner,
they campaigned against it, in fact.
Specifically against it, that's right.
So What does he do? Does he have a plan?
Yes, he does. His plan is, and this is what we will see, it's part of what makes it an interesting time, even really between now and the installation of the 112th Congress, is his plan is to, as he put it to me, give them a confront them with what is a really serious adult moment, and to sort of, as again, as he put it to me, educate them on how important this is, the pretty grave consequences if we don't do this, and he believes he will, you know, convince them that this isn't worth it. It's not good for the country, and it's not good for the party. It's not good for this Congress if in fact we have this fight over this, and that's what we'll see.
But there have been a lot of potential adult moments. There's a whole issue of taxing the very rich, people who make $1 million or more, because the deficit is growing. Congress members on both sides, in the Senate anyway, voted against.
Well, the wind was very much at the back of Republicans on that issue, as you'll remember. I mean, you know, 20 minutes ago, this was a Congress that was, in fact, this very moment, it's a Congress that was controlled by Democrats. And this was an issue that quite consciously was not resolved before the election. And the reason, of course, that it wasn't resolved before the election is because it was not politically popular. As crazy as that might seem, that in at this disastrous economic moment for so many people, that it would not be a popular theme to say, let's just tax millionaires, but, you know, give a tax break to the middle class and working class. In fact, the message caught on out there that no one should be taxed, aside from whether or not it was millionaires or small businesses, that no taxes should be raised in this deep recession with this kind of unemployment. And I think Republicans know that at this instant anyway, and in the present future, that issue is, they're on the right side of that issue politically.
Well, when Newt Gingrich took over leadership, he came in with the Contract for America, and there was this real sense of a new vision.
Yes.
Is John Boehner purposely not trying to be like Newt Gingrich?
Yes, he is.
Wasn't Newt Gingrich, didn't he ride Newt Gingrich's coattails early in his career?
He did. He was a Newt guy. He was one of the Gang of Seven in his freshman and sophomore terms. The Gang of Seven being that group of very conservative Republicans who just tortured the old bulls of that Congress on things like the House Bank and franking privileges, the House Post Office, and stuff like that. He was of that, very much of that moment, and rose into leadership once Newt won his majority. But Newt, working that close to Newt Gingrich, he saw a couple of things. He saw, one, that by being so out front and so controversial and so divisive a figure as Newt Gingrich was as House Speaker, that allowed the Democratic president of that time, Bill Clinton, to pivot, to triangulate, and to, in fact, outlast Newt Gingrich, which is what he did. Boehner doesn't want to, and probably couldn't be, even if he did, so singular, dominant a presence as Gingrich was. And even if he could, he knows that that's not necessarily a fruitful course.
Now, Peter, before we go into a break, and we're going to take a short one and come back and talk more, I do have one more question that has to be answered right now. Why did John Boehner even agree to talk to you? You're a staff writer for The New Yorker.
Yeah.
Wouldn't he see The New Yorker as a, what word do I want to use, the enemy?
Well, I think that it would not have been unreasonable for him and his team to assume that much of the mainstream press would not necessarily be interested in giving, you know, them a fair shake. I know that that's how an awful lot of conservatives see the mainstream press. On the other hand, I didn't just pick up the phone and call and say, could I have John Boehner? And they delivered him. Well, I did pick up the phone and call and say, could I have John Boehner? But it took 2.5 months of some very heavy lifting. And involving, you know, I'd been spent some time in Ohio with his family. I met his childhood friend. I back and forth to Washington, and I think they saw the course of my reporting. And you know, he just sort of, I think, just took a chance and decided to talk.
My guest is Peter J. Boyer, who is a staff writer for The New Yorker, and his article on John Boehner called House Rules appears in the current issue, the December 13th issue of that magazine. We'll continue our conversation after this. We're back with Peter J. Boyer, a staff writer for The New Yorker, who's written an article called House Rules, in which he reveals what he learned from talking a lot with John Boehner about his plans for the upcoming Congress. The article appears in the December 13th issue of The New Yorker, the current issue. John Boehner has often been described as either being like Dean Martin or Don Draper. He dresses well, plays golf a lot, smokes, but he's also pointed out many times that he's come from humble beginnings, and let's play a little clip of him talking about that.
Listen, I don't love you. Know I started out mopping floors, waiting tables, and tending bar at my dad's tavern. I put myself through school, working every rotten job there was. And in every night shift I could find. And I poured my heart and soul into running a small business.
That was from his emotional election night speech. Has becoming House Speaker been a long-term goal for Boehner or something that he's built up to during his political career?
It has been a long-term goal. What struck me is an interesting fact. I mean, he is not, unlike Newt Gingrich, for example, who is, like him or loathe him, he is a visionary. He's an idea machine. He's an historian. He sees himself as having been called by history, does Gingrich, to this moment, to this politics in this country at this time, and which is why he's always talking about American civilization and so on. Gingrich believed that being elected speaker was akin to being prime minister of this nation, and in fact, that's how he proceeded to try to govern for a time. Boehner, you can't quite imagine that. I mean, you can't imagine Boehner with any felicity suddenly placing, I mean, off the top of his head, this election in its historical context or comparing it to the election of 1896, as Newt Gingrich could do without skipping a beat. Boehner is a guy who literally was a fellow who grew up in a family of 12, kind of plotted his way through, joined the Navy, was out after 6 months because of a bad back, worked his way but in very unglamorous jobs through Xavier University. 7 years later, gets his degree. When he made himself pretty prosperous in a business, it was one of the most unglamorous businesses you could imagine. It was a sales team, basically manufacturers' representatives who sold packaging, little plastic pieces for packages that went in, you know, into places like Walmart. He has not been a visionary, in short, and yet, from the start, he has had his own idea of how the House should operate. And having lost his position most ingloriously after once holding a leadership position, instead of leaving, instead of going to the back benches, instead of going out and just enjoying golf and private life, he stayed in the House, went back to the back bench, and worked his way back. In fact, he established a kitchen cabinet, he called it, of his close associates in the House and said, "Here's my plan. I am going to be Speaker of the House of Representatives," and just sort of through perseverance and having a very keen ear to the sounds and rhythms of his own conference within the House, here he is.
Well, isn't it rumored that he was among those who actually helped push Gingrich out?
Yeah, there was a rumor that he still denies, although some people around Gingrich say, look, he was one of them. In fact, the leadership table under Gingrich, Army and Boehner and Tom DeLay and a fellow you may remember called Bill Paxson from New York, after about a year and a half, had sort of reached an exasperation point with Newt Gingrich and had, you know, sort of said to themselves, and in fact at a luncheon among themselves one day, were talking about the fact that Newt had so many attributes, such great ideas, and he was also just so exhausting. And one of them said to me, you know, in 1997 he was laying out plans for 2012 elections, and it was just hard to there was a disconnect between what they saw as, you know, the necessary connection to the business of running the House, and a group of young, excuse me, Republicans were ready to throw him out. The fact that Boehner and these others knew about it sort of implicated them. Boehner said that he knew about it but didn't participate. But as I say in my piece, a couple of the people around Gingrich to this day hold Boehner accountable along with the others.
Does Boehner's perpetual tan, which has gotten him kitted an awful lot, but which he says is a skin pigmentation issue, his willingness to play golf, meet with lobbyists, have they all earned him a reputation of not working that hard? It's obvious he does work hard.
He does work hard. I mean, I think, but within limits. Again, he's not a Gingrich who, you know, lives, eats, drinks, and sleeps and dreams this stuff. I mean, one of the most revealing things said to me, I went down to Washington and spent a little bit of time with a former colleague of Boehner's in the House, Republican member of the House, who is now, of course, a lobbyist, a guy called Jim McCrary. McCrary considers himself a close friend and, in fact, a defender of Boehner. And in defending Boehner against this very charge of being lazy and just not that interested in, you know, a nine-to-fiver, basically, is what the rap against Boehner is. He said, yeah, all of that's true. He's not a dynamo. He does like his smokes. He does like his Merlot at the end of the day. But he does know how to get things done. And I suppose, I guess that is probably the ultimate answer so far. He must, or he wouldn't be here.
My guest is Peter J. Boyer, staff writer for The New Yorker. His article, House Rules, appears in the December 13th issue of that magazine. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, Boehner, as we point out, has extensive ties to lobbyists. Has that caused him political embarrassment in the same way that the charges of influence peddling did in the mid-1990s?
Yeah, I mean, it has a couple of times. I got to say that the first instance, there was a moment that you say to yourself, what could anyone have been thinking? There was a moment that it was the 1997, I believe it was, but anyway, before Congress was a piece of legislation that directly affected tobacco. I think it was tobacco subsidies, in fact. And so tobacco lobbyists had an interest, of course, in getting their people on board. And in what was a legal move, they wrote checks out, contribution checks to various Republican legislators, and gave them to Boehner, who crazily agreed to be the messenger and hand these checks out to his colleagues, and did so on the House floor as this legislation was pending. Now, I mean, it would seem the most grotesque example of of influence peddling. It was technically not against the House rules. It was not technically illegal or anything, but it was just so I guess tone deaf to the appearance of propriety that it haunts him still, I think. And I mean, he said, now that I think about it, of course, even though it was technically appropriate, that, I mean, technically allowed, it was inappropriate, and, you know, hasn't done it since, and in fact worked for the rule that would make such behavior impermissible. There have been other times when you know he has been in my piece I think I refer to him as the representative from K Street. He is sort of unashamed of always having being an available ear to the interests of business.
Well, how does that play with some of the other young people who are in leadership positions? Eric Cantor is seen as next in line for leader. Do they see Boehner as an old guard conservative?
I think they absolutely do. I think that they don't. I don't think they worry so much as the press and Democrats do about Boehner's connection to business. I mean, this is a business conference we're talking about. The Republicans, especially at this moment, they are very pro-business, especially pro-small business. But what I think their concern is aside from their own ambitions, of course, which are quite considerable, is the degree to which Boehner is going to be able to handle this moment. Is he going to fall to a default position, an institutional establishment position on some really key issues when the moment arises? During the campaign, as you know, the Republican position had been regarding the Bush tax cuts. We are for extending all of them forever. That's our position. Boehner was asked by Bob Schieffer one Sunday morning, well, look, if the only thing you're presented is an extension on the working class and on the middle class tax cuts, but not for the rich folks, would you vote for that? And he said, well, if that's the only option I have, yes, I would. It sounded like compromise to the young guns, as they call themselves, those in the leadership of the Republican Party below Boehner. And, I mean, within 24 hours, they had him in full retreat.
Well, wasn't Eric Cantor more active in shaping the debate over the stimulus than John Boehner was?
He was, because it is very much Boehner's style, and this may be his strength. It was very much his style to delegate, and to, for example, he has a whip. His whip was Eric Cantor, and it fell to Eric Cantor and his whip team to whip that vote on President Obama's stimulus package. Cantor had quite brilliantly, from a political standpoint, really prepared the ground with his own party, within his own conference. First of all, by developing an alternative with Paul Ryan and Kevin McCarthy and others, an alternative stimulus package, which he presented to the president, which occasioned the famous Obama remark, Eric, elections have consequences, and we won. Well, it allowed Eric Cantor to then whip his party on that vote, where they got precisely the thing they needed, which was a 100% no. And that so enthused the Republican conference that, I mean, in a way, it was the turning point of the last 2 years politically, I think, was that no vote on the stimulus. That wasn't Boehner doing it.
And hasn't Obama's quip backfired? Now the Republicans are saying the same thing to him.
Yes, that's right.
Now, what about Pat Ryan and Kevin McCarthy? It seems to me that all of the young guns in the Republican Party, all the new leaders, are not John Boehner types. So how is he going to work with his own leadership?
Well, that's what we are going to see. I will say, though, I mean, when I say he's a delegator, it was to these folks that he delegated. He took Kevin McCarthy and said, you're going to be in, I want you at my side. I want you to be in charge of this Pledge to America project, which in fact he was. He was with Kevin McCarthy out in Kevin McCarthy's district in Bakersfield when he first beheld a Tea Party rally. Cantor, of course, was delegated the position of doing that stuff. And Paul Ryan, who is sort of the designated thinker of Republicans in the House, who's the one who's constantly wrestling with plans to try to reform, somehow come up with entitlement reform. He's very impatient about all of this stuff, really wants to get going, completely sympathizes with the Tea Party impulse to rein in government and to do it now. And yet he, you know, he said to me, I got to be honest with you, this was a politically toxic thing, and Boehner never once suggested I tone it down and stop talking about it. So, you know, Boehner says this is what a good manager does. It's how you manage a business. You give them enough. You know, you let them blow off steam. You let them go their way. If you don't, he said to me, you get an explosion. And, you know, maybe it'll work.
Well, last week, Boehner said of the president's bipartisan deficit commission proposals that it, quote, provides a sobering look at the tough choices that lay ahead, that lie ahead.
Yeah.
And he urged, again, an adult conversation. He loves that, to talk about adult conversations. On the scope of our fiscal challenges, I believe the commission's work will help do that. Well, what does that mean within this Congress and with the Republican membership that he's now faced with leading?
It's a good question, and it's an interesting turn of phrase, an adult conversation. He used it a couple of times with me. He has used it in publicly when he's making these public pronouncements on things like the president's deficit commission, and it's code for the only way this will ever get addressed is if our side doesn't demagogue it and if Democrats don't demagogue it. If we don't, in other words, deal with the issue of entitlement reform as politicians, but rather do it as grown-ups, you know, sitting around the table having to actually, you know, balance a budget, a family budget, it's not going to get done. And there are people on his side who voted against it, Paul Ryan, for one, because it didn't do enough. It didn't, for example, address health care in the way that Ryan thinks it should be. So how this adult conversation actually is going to occur is going to, if you, again, by my premise that adult conversation means actually doing something about this stuff, is going to be a real trick for Boehner. I think you'll begin to see the answer when the House budget is drawn up, and that's going to be done by the new Budget Committee Chairman, Paul Ryan. And I bet you, in fact, I can almost guarantee you that some version of Ryan's plans for Medicare, Medicaid, dealing with health care is going to be represented in that budget.
Just one more thing. We talked about him learning from Newt Gingrich's style and doing the opposite. What has he learned from Nancy Pelosi's leadership style?
I think the same thing. I mean, I think, among other things, he felt that Republicans were given an awful lot of energy by the fact of the frustration of being in the minority under what he considered strong-arm tactics, how no air was let out of the room when legislation would come along, important legislation that Republicans weren't allowed to have a say in, that when legislation was all drawn up in the Speaker's office, that it basically subverted the healthy legislative process. He says he's going to try to bring real reforms to the legislative process, the way the House operates. It's tricky stuff. I mean, you know, it's not something that everybody goes along with, whatever their ideology. An appropriator wants his position. He wants to be able to hand out goodies for his folks. And Boehner has taken on the Republican appropriators, but now that he's Speaker, he's going to have actual say in a lot of this stuff.
Well, there's that real tit-for-tat problem. The Democrats said, well, when Newt Gingrich was in power, they wouldn't listen to us. They kept us out of all the discussion. So why should we be any different? And now John Boehner's going to change that?
Boehner says...
Peter, you probably should answer your follow.
Boehner says he is going to change that, that in fact the Democrats will be treated fairly and that they will have a voice in drawing it. They'll be able to bring amendments, for example.
We will see.
We
have to leave it there, unfortunately, and only time will tell what really is going to happen. But thank you so much for talking with us, Peter J. Boyer. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker, and his article, House Rules, is the lead article in the December 13th issue of The New Yorker. Thanks
My
again,
pleasure.
Peter.
Bye-bye.